What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
How is it possible that it's already August? We hope you are enjoying your summer. Back by popular demand is our AirPods Pro giveaway. Members who successfully answer our bonus content quiz will be entered for a chance to win a pair of AirPods Pro. To participate, you must have access to the bonus sections of the podcasts, which you get by becoming a member. Members also receive an ad-free listening experience, an evening newsletter, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, and more. Best of all, if you become a member in the month of August, you'll receive 50% off the normal membership price. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code BONUSCONTENT, one word, at checkout. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code BONUSCONTENT. Thank you for your support.
Nine. 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, David Rothkopf, coming to you today from dark, gray, really kind of foreboding-looking Washington, D.C. This is our first show of the week, and so it is Spy Show with Mark Polymeropoulos, my co-host. How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing great. I am once again on the road live from New Brunswick, New Jersey, where last night I took my son, who just turned 21, to see his first Metallica show.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a second. We are joined today by Alex Finley. Alex is a former officer of the CIA's Directorate of Operations, where she served in West Africa and Europe prior to joining the CIA. Alex was a journalist. She is the author of the Victor Caro series of satirical novels about the CIA. So that brings us right back to Mark. Going to see the Metallica concert, you're writing satirical novels about the CIA. Would you ever go so far as to have a character like Mark, who let's just say is over 40, going to a Metallica concert in New Jersey? He also alleges that when he was stationed overseas, all they played was Metallica. And how do you think that probably impacted their effectiveness?
I actually didn't know Mark before I wrote the books, and there's a character in there that he insists is him. I swear I did not know him at the time, but that wouldn't surprise me that Metallica was quite popular among the people out in the types of fields that Mark was working in.
Why do you say that? I mean, what explains that? The stresses, or that they'd lost touch with reality?
Why is this about me? What's happened to the show already?
I would probably say probably a little bit of both, because you do start living sort of on another planet, and it's definitely a stressful place to be. And I think, I don't know as much about Mark's history, but I think probably if you're embedded with military and stuff, you're probably getting a whole different slew of types of music that you get into. But maybe Mark really just liked Metallica from the beginning, and this has nothing to do with any of it.
See, that's right. No, okay. So now we're gonna dive into this a little bit, because here's the true story: is that I was reading, I think it was Victor in Trouble. There's a character there, the station chief, who is a bit of a boob. It's great satire, but as he's, I think it was as he's sitting in Europe, and this is where kind of the case officers have to do kind of the more refined kind of true espionage operations. He has a picture in the background of a Predator drone, and I read it. And I freaked out, because that was my office in multiple places with a picture of a drone. And I immediately pinged Alex on Twitter and I said, oh, my God, this is me. I was horrified, but of course, with a big smiley face. So you nailed it. Great character. And we're going to, throughout the podcast today, we're going to plug so much of your stuff, but certainly those books, which, you know, if you're in the agency, they're wonderful because there's so much reality. If you're not, you can just laugh and we can laugh at ourselves. And I think that's why Alex kind of nailed it with that book series.
Well, see, there you go, Alex. It certainly speaks to your skills as a novelist that you could dream up a character like Mark without having met him.
I didn't meet him specifically, but let's be clear. I definitely met that character.
Wait a second. You're saying that out there on the front lines at the pointy end of the spear for the United States, there are people who are boobs, as to use Mark's term?
I did not use that term. That's his term.
Immediately.
Yeah, well, let's get a little more serious. You also have a newsletter, Mark shared. You talked a little bit about how the recent indictment, the most recent indictment of the former president, is kind of a roadmap to how you do a self-coup. And I thought that was kind of interesting since it's not just happening here, it's happening in Israel. It happens in other places from time to time. And so I thought maybe one place we could start is to have you talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, if you read the indictment, it really does sort of outline a number of the steps that anybody doing a self-coup would do. So just to make clear to the audience that a self-coup is a little bit different than a coup d'etat. A coup d'etat is sort of where an outside force, usually a military or the junta, whatever, comes in and takes power in an undemocratic way. A self-coup is somebody who has been elected through democratic means and is in power, but then uses illegal means to remain in power. And so if you read Jack Smith's indictment of Trump, what Trump allegedly did really is a self-coup. It's using all of the levers of power around you to make sure that you stay in power. And it's installing your cronies in the Department of Justice and your cronies who are down in the state legislatures to make sure that they're doing your bidding. And the reasons that they do your bidding is out of loyalty, but loyalty only to an extent. It's really much more about maintaining their own position and power. And as long as you're the one who can give it to them, they'll remain loyal. And as soon as you're the one who cannot give it to them, then you start to see cracks. And so I think it's pretty interesting if you look at this Trump indictment. And as you said, it goes on elsewhere. I think Israel is a very good example right now. Putin, I would argue, has done self-coups where he's basically fixing the elections to make sure that he remains in power. And each step of the way, he's grabbing more power for himself. Nicolas Maduro, for sure, in Venezuela is an example of coming to power through a self-coup. So we do see it in a lot of different places. And part of my point in my newsletter rant last week was that, like, so if you look at the countries that do this, like Venezuela and like Russia, these aren't countries we want to emulate. And so what's so strange to me is where you see really one entire political party in our country going along with it and cheering it in many ways, and some of them allegedly helping it. And so we need to realize that we don't want to be Venezuela. We really don't. We're the United States of America. We got a lot going for ourselves that Venezuela does not. So let's not aim to be Venezuela, right? That's just not who we want to be, I don't think.
Well, I mean, it remains to be seen. Right, but the choice has not been fully made. I want to turn it over to Mark, but I want to ask you one last question as a quick follow-up here, just to go back to our earlier point about nitwits in high positions in the intelligence community. That part of this self-coup led to that. I mean, when you have Rick Grenell or Kash Patel or those kind of guys in the intelligence community with no intel experience, purely put in place because they're presumed to be loyal and to keep an eye on people who might actually be honoring their oath to the Constitution, that's got to lead to a lot of disastrous implications for the United States, but really great opportunities for satirical novelists.
It's actually harder, I think, for satirical novelists. I was writing Victor in Trouble, which is about a lot of this. It's about Russian influence operations against the United States. And so I was writing a lot of this as we were experiencing Trump's administration. And look, in Trump's administration, we saw from the very beginning total disdain for the national security community and for the intelligence community in particular. There was Trump's very first trip to CIA, which was problematic, to say the least. And then, as you said, the Cash Patels and the Rick Grinnells, but also giving Jared Kushner clearances when the people doing the background checks said there's no way that this guy should have it. And you could sort of get this feeling around Washington that having access to intelligence was much more about status and just being able to say that we have access to it. And it was treated more, that's it, as a status symbol than as we are serious policymakers who need access to this information to make the difficult decisions that we have to make. And so the problem when all of that's actually going on and you're trying to write satire is it's in real life, it's really sad and it really makes you angry. And it's a real problem that you're grappling with just as a former CIA officer, as a citizen, but then as the novelist trying to say, okay, but it's so absurd, I have to find a way to explain to the reader why this is problematic, but in a fun and entertaining and accessible way.
Yeah. Now, well, I mean, a perfect example of what you're saying is Trump on the tape about the alleged Iran war plan document turns to his crew and says, isn't this cool? I mean, it was really kind of amazing that, you know, after his presidency, he feels compelled to say stuff like that. Mark?
So, Alex, I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, one of the things I just kind of as a little kind of peek behind the scenes is a lot of us formers, we have kind of an informal network. And I will say that Alex really is considered not a, but the expert on Russian information operations. So while you're writing these satirical novels, you also, there's a very serious side to you. And so your newsletter is fantastic. And what you have to say is really important. But I think you picked up on something that's interesting when you said, you know, we all had a sense of anger. And I think that really is correct. And so let's jump forward in terms of Russian information operations now. We have a country, obviously, that's going right now through some political dysfunction. And I think, you know, we haven't seen anything yet. There's going to be trials. The 24 election cycle is going to be probably a nightmare. So how do you, as one of the preeminent experts on Russian, what we call IO, how do you see the Russians taking advantage of this? You know, obviously there's a lot they did in 2016. They continue to do so. But what do you anticipate them doing? What can we expect? And most importantly, how do we combat that?
Yeah, that's the billion-dollar question. Definitely, Russia is going to take advantage of the disruption that we already have going on. One of the mantras of covert action at CIA is you cannot create conditions on the ground. You can only exploit the conditions that already exist. And so that's where Russia really is good. They find that sweet spot. They say, okay, where's the wedge? Where is the problem that we can go in and exploit and use to our own advantage? And we're seeing it already. We've seen it. We saw it from before the 2016 election. We've seen it, you know, since. But we're definitely seeing it now. And one thing to keep in mind is, you know, there are different audiences that Russian propaganda and information warfare is going after. There's the internal Russian audience where they need to convince their own people that Putin is right, that this war is right, that the U.S. is the cause of all of this bad, or that the West in general is the cause of all of this bad. And then there are the external audiences, which are, you know, us. And that's where we see the social media and the trolls coming and trying to convince us of different things. But we already see it. We see amplification of Trump's talking points this past weekend. His lawyers and his cronies were all over the media, you know, giving what I guess his legal defense is going to be, even though there's nothing legal about it. But they're definitely setting the narrative, because it is not just a legal issue. It will become a political issue as we get closer and closer to the election. And so I think you already see, a number of personalities and influencers already pushing those same talking points. Now, this is where it gets very complicated. So this is why I actually have an online course about Russian influence operations, about foreign influence operations and how it works. People then come to me and say, well, are these people Russian agents? No, not necessarily. But what you have is a network that has been created and ideas and philosophies that feed into those networks. And people see it within their own interest to promote those certain ideas. Now, some of them are Russian agents. We know of a number of journalists and influencers and politicians who are paid by the Russians to promote some of these talking points. But then you have this organic part where people just truly believe this. And so they hear more people saying it. And so they'll start saying it themselves because they feel safe to say it, or it's good to be part of the crowd that's saying it. And so we do already see a lot of the narratives moving through those networks and reaching out onto sort of more mainstream platforms, even if they started in sort of the corners of the internet.
Yeah. What do you expect? I mean, here we are, 15 months out from an election that is hugely consequential to Russia, because
anti-Ukraine,
you know, they're unlikely to win in Ukraine unless we have a change of leadership here in the United States. So, you know, it's kind of part of the war effort. Do you expect we'll see new things? And parenthetically in that question, In 2016, part of this operation was Prigozhin and his gang, who oddly enough is still alive. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. But does shutting down his gang have any effect on this?
Well, so to start with the Prigozhin point, I'm not convinced that he won't be part of this. I think part of the reason he is still alive is because he's still useful. He has the networks to do a lot of the chaos that we've talked about. But we also have to remember he's not the only one. So that the Internet Research Agency that we heard about in Robert Mueller's report, for example, and I think is sort of the most famous troll farm that we hear about, is hardly the only one. So there are a lot of these. They have, of course, built more. They have more oligarchs probably funding others. So just because one is shut down, you know, there are plenty of others that can happen. I think we're going to see a lot of chaos. I think it's going to be very hard for the truth to break through. That's not to say that most of the country won't know what the truth is. But part of what is so annoying about this technique that the Russians use, and which others now, of course, have learned from and use, it is this flooding the zone or the fire hose of falsehood that we talk about. When you're throwing out so many different narratives, which Russia does, which Trump does, which we see from all kinds of different bad actors, the problem is, I think, that the media hasn't learned how to respond. And so, and some of us influencers or personalities who sort of know about these things, we also don't always know how to respond. Your instinct is to say, well, that's wrong, and here's why that's wrong. But you're now discussing the false information. You're not getting the true narrative through. And I think that is something we really need to work on over the next 15 months, is you just can't. You're never going to swat away every false narrative. So what you need to focus on is getting the true narrative, the truth, out, and just keep focusing on that. I don't think that the Democratic Party has mastered that yet. I think Biden is better at that. I think the Obama administration was fearful to do so in the run-up to 2016 because there were political consequences. I mean, I think Obama really thought, if I come out and I say that Russia is doing this without Republican support and McConnell refused to give it, that it really would look political, and that was going to be problematic. And so he kind of backed down. But a lot of the people who are now working for Biden are those same people who seem to have learned their lessons. So we have seen from the Biden administration in the run-up to Ukraine, for example, the Ukraine invasion, releasing little bits of this information. Hey, we know that this is what Russia is going to do. We know that these are the false stories that they're going to tell. So that when it comes, we as consumers of information can say, oh, okay, that makes more sense now. But combating this in the long run is much more complicated, and it gets into civic education, and it's a whole infrastructure of information and how we consume our information that needs to be changed.
No doubt, Mark.
Yeah, so I think I look back to I retired in 2019. So when I left, I had actually switched from that old CT world, which we were just making fun of me about. And I went over and I was
We were making fun of you about Metallica.
Okay,
I want to be clear about that.
I was the ops chief in Europe and Eurasia, and one of the things that what we saw was this inability to have that kind of a war room mentality, because the Russians were, as Alex said, flooding the zone. And one of the things that we tried to do, and I think that, and Alex, you mentioned it, this has to do with these authorized intelligence disclosures, but it's the importance of exposing Russian information operations or Russian disinformation, when we see it. So it's the actual gathering of intelligence and then telling the world. But it's, you almost have to do it on a 24/7 basis. So I agree, it's difficult, but really important. I just want to switch just a bit, because I think you can really help some of the listeners on something that really bothers me. As someone who served in the field, lived overseas, I am always interested on how the world perceives the United States. You actually, Alex, are living abroad. And so I think that you can give some really interesting perspective, because I still, just for me, I still have, occasionally have this notion of America as a, bright shining city on a hill. You go to a U.S. embassy anywhere, the consular section, there's still long lines. People still want to come to the United States, but it's getting a little shaky. And Alex, you'll remember a lot of things we did overseas in an embassy. We did a lot of finger wagging at countries that didn't adhere to the rule of law and democracy. Now it's a, I think we have to look at ourselves in the mirror. But how does the world see us? Simple question, and really important question.
Yeah, it is an important question. I would separate out sort of the general public. I'll just stick with Europe, just because, like you said, that's where I live, and so that's what I know. I would separate out the general public and then the policymakers. I think among the general public, there still really is, as you said, a love for America, a love for sort of our ideals. The notion that you can come as nobody and become somebody, I think that's still really strong. And I think that is exactly why you still see very long lines to get a visa to the United States. You don't see long lines to, go to Saudi Arabia or go to China. They want to come here, or they want to come to Europe. They want Western values. The policymakers, on the other hand, it's quite different. I think there really is a concern among policymakers about what's going to happen in the next election. When Trump came in, it was a shock to the system, because there had been this interdependence, some would say a reliance, and I think that's probably fair to an extent, that Europe was counting a little bit too much on us. They got over that, and they started now doing much more. They're putting more money towards their own defense. They're discussing among themselves, okay, how do we have a collective security in Europe? But then Biden came in, and it got a little bit, okay, we're back. It's going to be fine. And I think now they're starting to realize again, oh, wait, it might not be fine. So there's definitely concern, I would say, at the EU level as to what is going to happen in this next election. I think there's still not a misunderstanding, but a low gauging of the threat from Russia. The Ukraine war has brought it more into stark relief, but I think there's still some naivete about just how far Russia will go, or in terms of pushing for this. Oh, if we just give him an off ramp or that kind of thing, we hear those same narratives in Europe, and it's really the Baltic states and Poland. It's the states who've had that history with Russia, who say, no, we can't let that happen. They'll say whatever they need to say, but we need to make sure that we're acting in our own security. But I also want to point out this dynamic that we see in the United States of the far right and the far left, because we do have far left parties and actors that are being influenced and paid by Russians and by Chinese and by others to influence what our policies are in the United States. Those same dynamics are at work in Europe. So they're not completely eyes shut to what's going on. And so when they look at our politics, they understand to a certain amount that it's happening their politics as well. And you have parties that are being funded by some of these people. The French election last year, if you think, you know, it was Emmanuel Macron against Marine Le Pen. And you know, it's sort of the same feeling. It was the same feeling in France that then that it is in the United States now. If Le Pen had won, that would have changed the entire calculus for Europe in terms of taking on Russia and dealing with the Ukraine war. And I think we're feeling now the same thing in the United States. Which leader is in charge is totally going to set which trajectory, not just our country goes on, but the collective West.
I might add, uncertainty about which leader is in charge has its own consequence, right? So, you know, if we seem to be vacillating back and forth, one path to another, then we become an unreliable partner in any event. The system not functioning to provide the stability it has in the past. This is the moment where we take a break and we say thanks to all of you who have been listening, who are in the general public, and that we're going to now move on to the members-only portion of the podcast. It's always full of great and interesting information, so you should be a member so you don't miss it. Go to thegsrnetwork.com, click on membership. It's $5 a month, and that helps us do programming like this, which, as you have heard already, is super valuable, and as the members will hear, gets even more so in the next section. For now, thanks to everybody who is in not a member, please become one. And for the members, please stand by.